Boy, isn't that fast service? I asked him last Friday. Others had asked too. So now we have a bell. We're just like regular folks up here. Hallelujah. Okay. We left off in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 9. But first of all, if you recall, last Friday, a question was asked regarding chapter 1, verse 16. It says, "And I will utter my judgments." And I said that it was set. But it's in the future here. And I just want to clarify that. It is in the future. I told you I would look it up and make sure whether or not it was in the future. And it is in the future. And it is referring to future judgment, and that's what's in view. But at the time when God brings forth these judgments, and when God brings forth these judgments, this is when it will be uttered. Okay, so it is in a future thing. However, the vision is given specifically to show that the judgment is set. Okay, and I think that's what I said last Friday, but I wanted to clarify it to you. It is to show that the judgment is set. And by Jeremiah's time, the options were only regarding the severity of judgment, not whether or not they would occur. In other words, the judgment was set and it was sure. Okay? So even though he puts it in the future tense and it will take place in the future, it's set. The judgment is set. And it was just a matter of the degree of severity as to what would actually transpire. And that was the only thing that was uncertain about it at all. So they didn't really have any options. Remember, as we said they had three choices. They could undergo judgment and stay in the land if they would hear right then and there. But they were still going to undergo judgment. Their land was going to be taken over by the Babylonians. Or if they didn't hear, then if they submitted, they could live. And if they didn't submit, they were going to die. Or at least the majority of them were. So anyway, the judgment was set, even though this is set in the future tense. So back to verse 9 in chapter 2 then. "Wherefore I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and with your children's children will I plead." Now this word plead here, first of all, in verse 8, you remember he's been talking about the those that were entrusted with precious truths. Okay, they were entrusted with precious truths and they failed. Okay, and because of their failure, now he's going to plead with them. He said, "I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and with your children's children will I plead." Now this is a legal term. It's a plaintiff presenting his case in court to a judge. Okay, he's going to present his case to them. But in this case, God is the plaintiff. He's also the judge and the executioner. And they are already guilty. And it's known. So how is he going to plead with them? Through judgment. And that's just what he said in Leviticus 26, verses 14 and following. He said that he would plead with them by means of judgment. He offered to bless them. Back in Leviticus, he gives the blessings and the cursings, and he offered to bless them. But if they wouldn't hear, they wouldn't hearken, if they wouldn't obey, then they were going to undergo judgment. And so this is how he's going to plead with them now. He's pled with them through the prophets for years now. The prophets have come and preached and preached and preached and preached to them. And now he's going to plead with them through judgment. And this is the way God works. It's not the way he wants to work, but it's the way he works. It's the way he's working in this assembly right now in certain ways. He's pled with us for years. Our pastor preached for years and years and years and years and years about all these things. You go back and listen to the tapes from 10, 12, 14, 15 years ago, and in one sense, the message hasn't changed a bit. It's just that God has been pleading with us. Get your marriages in order. Now, sometimes there's been more specific direction than that, or, you know, get rid of demons, take care of these problems, commit yourself, go to the cross. I mean, the message has never changed. The message of the gospel is really very simple. And it's just go to the cross. Go to the cross and die. You know, and it's various areas that we have to go to the cross and die in. And we need understanding to know what to do and how to do it. But the message is the same. It's been preached the same and will continue to be preached the same. And it's a matter of whether we'll listen. And if we won't listen, then God will plead with us through other means. And that is judgment that comes upon us. And this is what's been happening to a lot of people in the assembly. In fact, virtually everybody has been undergoing one form of judgment or another. They've been coming under one kind of stress or difficulty, and God did say that it was necessary that it happened that way. To have the warrior bride that he needs, we have to undergo these things. It's not necessarily pleasant, but in fact, we in reality deserve it anyway. I mean, because we're not perfect, and it's all, you know, the fact that it's so, the judgment is so light. In reality, it is very light. Because the judgment is light because of his mercy. Okay, and so in reality, we deserve these things. But he's also taking them and using them for our benefit, to strengthen us. To strengthen us. And we're going to need that strength in the future. And he said, this is the way I have to do it. I have to do it this way. Otherwise, you won't be strong in the hour when the temptation comes. See, it says of Jesus in Hebrews that he learned obedience by that which he suffered. Now, he was perfect. He didn't sin. And yet he had to learn obedience by that which he suffered. Paul?
It reminds me of the saints in the tribulation.
That's right. Yeah.
That's
right. The tribulation saints is the same thing. They will be, God will plead with them through judgment that they might be proven, that they might be found obedient. Now, they had the option to miss that, but in reality, we're all going to go through tribulation. In this world, ye shall have tribulation. That's what he said. You shall have tribulation. Why? Because he's proving our faith. He's proving our faith. So God is pleading with them. They're guilty, and he's going to plead with them through judgment in this case, because he's pled with them and offered mercy to them, even though they've been undergoing a judgment up to this point in time. He's pled with them through smaller judgments. The pastor talked about this, phase one judgment, phase two judgment. You know, they underwent judgment through various stages, and it wasn't necessarily severe as what this is going to be. But now, because they wouldn't listen, and this is over a long period of time, now he has to plead with them a little bit stronger. In fact, it's going to be very strong. And he will plead with them as long as possible, to the children's children. He'll continue to plead. That's the way his heart is. That's his mercy. He will plead and plead and plead. He will plead with a man until the man dies and goes to the lake of fire, until there is no more time for pleading. There's no more time to change. He will plead with a man. He will seek to see a man saved that long. Now, there is a time when God will say, don't waste your time anymore on this person. And that has happened. Don't waste your time anymore on him. But that doesn't mean that God has totally given up on him, because the man will undergo judgment. He's going to be in judgment in his life. This is some of the spiritual laws. We'll be talking about that in a minute. Some of the spiritual laws that God has laid down make it so that if you don't walk with God, you're going to undergo judgment. And that's not just because God is going to be actively judging you, but his laws are just going to work on you. And that's all there is to it. It's the way he said it. And so he will plead that way with people, and he does. He continues to plead with people that way. This is why many conversions take place when people are at the bottom of the barrel, and they finally hit bottom. They say, well, there's nothing else to do, you know. Well, God has pled with them. You know, it didn't have to be that way, but God has pled with them. So, anyway, he will continue to plead. That's his heart of love for his people. Verse 10. For pass over the isles of Kittim, and see, and send unto Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Now, here he's making his case. He's going to make his case. Go to Kittim, that is the Isle of Cyprus, as we see in Genesis 10:4. That is the people to the west. Okay, go to the west. Look to the west. And go to Kedar. That is the Arabian desert, the people to the east. We see that in Genesis 25:13. Point of note on Kedar is that it means to be dark or dark-skinned, as in Arabians. That's where we get the idea of the Arabians here, and the people to the east. And the root idea is to be turbid. That is, it deals with turbidity, deals with winemaking. Okay, what it means is that the lees are not settled. The lees are the things that need to settle out, all the heavy particles in the wine, all the, you know, bits of skin and things like that from the grape. And the lees, if they haven't settled out, they're all mixed up. They're all mixed up in. And so the wine is very cloudy. And it's very dark, therefore. Okay? And so it has the idea of being clouded with sin. In other words, this is the picture that's being presented. It's a type of sin. You know, the wine is unsettled. It's mixed up. It's muddy. It's unclear. Okay? And so we have a type of sin here. So he's saying, go to those that are full of sin. And we'll see that in the next verse when he's when he talks about them. So go to the east and go to the west. Go to those that are full of sin. And see. See. Look all around. Do even the heathen thus? Do they do the same things that you're doing? Now what this is pointing up is the power of the devil against God's people. Now it's their own sin and their own unwillingness, yes. But these were God's chosen people, and they were chosen because God knew that they, of all the people, would walk with Him, if any would. Okay? So these are God's people, and He's chosen them. But it shows the power of the devil against God's chosen people. Very powerful. We're learning that. And see, up to this point in time, it's been just mercy. It's just been mercy. We've had opportunity to deal with what you might call little demon spirits. I mean, they seem powerful in our life, and they've had a lot of power in our life, but really, the deception that is coming is so strong, and the demons are so powerful that we have not yet dealt with, that, I mean, we would be astounded if we really understood the power of the devil. I mean, we've always taken, well, you know, that he can come as an angel of light. Well, yeah, but I'll know. See, I'll know, because God is with me. You know, that kind of presumption, if any man think that he stand, let him take heed lest he fall. You know, that kind of thing, that's the very thing that will lead you right into deception. Right into deception. Thinking, well, I'm not going to be like them. I'm not going to be deceived. You know, there are people in this assembly who have moved into certain areas in this move that were not of God, and they thought they were, and they're convinced of it. Some of them were convinced of it. Many are turning around now. But they were certain. They were absolutely certain. I mean, they were certain. Very clear. Very clear. And some of it was very deceptive. And I mean, to those who didn't get involved in it, you know, and I wasn't, and I look at it, and you know, and the natural mind says, even common sense tells you, you know, even common sense tells you these things. Just shows the power of the devil. Mm-hmm. The power of the devil. Because they were convinced. I think the pastor may be sharing part of a vision sometime in the near future. He shared it at the last meeting on Tuesday. And that's the thing that was on my heart, that the power of the devil is so strong, and it looks so beautiful, and it looks so marvelous, and it seems so good and so right, but it's just deception. And that's the power of the devil. It is really deceptive, and we need to take heed of that. So we see the power of the devil against God's people. See, in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1, Paul said that there is fornication named among you, such as not is named among the Gentiles. Now, wait a minute. These are Christian people. How could this be? Even the Gentiles aren't doing what this, you know, in this particular case, one man was doing. Even the Gentiles don't do this. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that you become Christian and you become more evil? No, it means the devil is, you know, he's got the heathen out there. He doesn't have to necessarily work any harder on them. He doesn't have to bring them into greater deception. So what's he do? He works on the Christians a lot harder. He pours out his demonic forces on them. Because if he can make the name of Jesus blasphemed among the Christians, I mean, that destroys the whole testimony. It's been God's grace and mercy that this church has been protected up to this point. I'm so thankful. And we need to continue to pray for God's protection, because he's protecting this people. It's like what John Bergen said last night. There should be, you know, hundreds of people should have left because of all the demonic activity that's been going on. Those, I've talked with some of them, and they're spending their lives, I mean, all day long, dealing with people that are in deep trouble. I mean, deep trouble, terrible things that are going on. Hurtful things in their marriages. Demonic activity such as we've never experienced before. And so it's the mercy of God that people are still here. It really is. We need to take heed of this. But you can see the power of the devil against God's people. He really hates us. And it's becoming more and more evident. He's going to teach us how to war. And one of the ways he's going to teach us how to war is he's going to show us how strong the battle is and how much we need to know how to war. So that we will come to him and say, Lord, strengthen my hands to war. Did you have a question here?
That word, Shittim, you said there was another place that was called that later.
Cyprus. It's the same. It's the same as Cyprus. Yeah. Yeah. It's also spelled Kittim. Okay, instead of with a ch. It's just how they transliterated it here in this place. Okay, verse 11. Hath a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which doth not profit. See, God is their glory. That's what it says in Psalms 106:20 and Romans 1:23. God is their glory, and they've changed their glory. See, the heathen are faithful to their false gods. I mean, they'll follow their false gods. You go, and even today, you know, they've got their rock band, and that they follow it. I mean, they're faithful. They're faithful. They're not fickle like God's people. This is what he's saying. The heathen are even. Look at the heathen. They follow their false gods. But Israel is unfaithful to the true God. How can this be? Well, again, it's the power of the devil working. The power of the devil. He doesn't have to get... They're following the false gods already. They're following demon spirits. They're full of them. They live with them. They love them. They worship them. Why does he have to work on them? He doesn't. I mean, he's working, yes. He's keeping them all bound up and getting them deeper and deeper in. But it's not like he has to work real hard at it. So he can spend all of his effort on God's people to bring them to this place. Now, it is their own unwillingness. Their own unwillingness. But it's the power of the devil, too. And he says they changed their glory for that which does not profit. See, godliness is profitable. Ungodliness is not. Godliness is profitable. We see this in 1 Timothy 4, chapter 4, verse 8, and chapter 6, verse 6, where it says, godliness with contentment is great gain. So they changed. They changed for that which does not profit. They didn't even see it. They couldn't even see it. They thought it was profitable. Why? Because it was profitable for the flesh. You know, sin hath pleasure for a season. It does have pleasure for a season. We need to be aware of that. You know, it used to be preached, well, you know, that this is terrible, you get out of sin, it's horrible, and your life is a misery. And other people say, wait a minute, I'm having a lot of fun here. Now, I'm sure their life was misery, but they couldn't see. You know, it says that the gospel, to those that won't receive it, it's a savor of death unto death. You know, I mean, it smells like death to them, because what are you preaching? Well, go to the cross. Yeah, but that's not much fun. I mean, I'm having fun here. Well, yes, you are. But to those that will receive, it's a savor of life unto life. There's that abundant life. Now, it takes a little different form. It's not always that way, but I'm sometimes, you know, I said to a sister the other day, I said, Jesus is fun. You know, he is. There's times when it's real difficult, and you got to go to the cross. But, you know, he's fun, too. And I don't mean it in a worldly sense, but there's delight and there's joy in him. And you can just be free before him. You know, he said, suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God. And what children have fun. They enjoy life. They're happy. There's innocence. They're naive about things that are evil and ugly and unclean. They have fun. They have fun. You know, and if they sin and do something wrong, that you punish them and forgive them. And you know what? 30 seconds later, it's like it never happened. And you think, now, wait a minute. You know, we have this view. Well, they should be feeling remorse and repentance and condemnation. You know, I mean, that's really what we're saying. You know, for the next 2 or 3 days thinking about this horrible thing. Now, wait a minute. Didn't you forgive them? Well, yeah, I guess I did. You know, well, what does forgiveness mean? It means it's cast as far as the east is from the west to be remembered against you no more. And so children, they get forgiven, and you know, of course, they're just like we are. And 5 minutes later, they're out doing the same thing, and you got to punish them again, you know, because it doesn't always take. But after a while, it does. But still, they can move, and they can just they don't suffer under condemnation until people bring it to them, until people fill them with those kind of spirits. So Jesus can be fun. He can be fun, but to the world, it doesn't seem so. See, godliness is profitable. It is profitable, not just for the future. But for now, you know, I love the life I lead. I do. You know, I love it. I wouldn't trade it for anything. They couldn't give me anything. You know, I pray that God will keep me in his hand all the time here, you know, but that I'm not speaking presumptuously, but I don't feel like they could tempt me with anything out there. I mean, I love the Lord, and it's so wonderful to walk with him. Anyway, verse 12. So the heathen, they're faithful, but my people aren't faithful. So what does God say? Be astonished, O ye heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be ye very desolate, saith the Lord. Be astonished, amazed, stunned, confounded with fear. It means to strike dumb. I mean, just be, it's just standing there. Can you believe such a thing? Can you believe such a thing? Be horribly afraid. This is a shuddering horror or terror. It also has the idea of reverence. Be very desolate. It has the idea of being dried up, desolate, as in a desert. In fact, the word for desert comes from the same word. See, rain is a blessing from heaven. Okay? He's talking to the heavens, remember? And rain is a blessing from heaven. But the heavens are commanded to be very desolate. That is totally dried up. No blessing coming down for them. See, the heavens are in there. It's a personification. And it's ascribing personal characteristics to the heavens. Human characteristics. And they are to be in great fear and horror. They are to be stunned by the sin of Israel and the impending judgment. They are to be stunned by the fact that Israel turned from the true God, when even the heathens will follow the false gods. It's an amazing thing. It is astounding to the mind. Now, when we understand the power of the devil, it's not so astounding. You know, as the pastor has said, everything is par for the flesh and the devil. And it really is. It really is. I can really say, I feel this too, and I may be tested in this further too, but nothing stumbles me anymore. Nothing stumbles me. I mean, I might be absolutely astounded and amazed and flabbergasted that such things would occur, but I'm not stumbled by it. I'm really not. I'm really not. Because the devil has such power and such strength that people fall into anything and everything. It's amazing. It's amazing. But God is gracious, merciful to help us. Verse 13, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Two evils, apostasy and idolatry. See, the heathen are only guilty of idolatry. They haven't apostatized. But idolatry, in this case of Israel, leads to apostasy. John says, keep thyself from idols, 1 John 5:21. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. Says, mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. This covetousness is idolatry. See, they coveted the things of the heathen. They looked at them and they looked good. This is what happened early on. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were beautiful. They coveted them. And it became idolatry to them. And it led them astray. They committed two evils, apostasy. They've forsaken me. They left the source of life. See, water was life to them. And this water was living water. And they left it. They forsook the living water. They didn't see what it was. They were complacent, apathetic. Here was the only true God who blessed them and moved in their life and brought them out of Egypt and did all these marvelous and wonderful things for them. But I mean, doesn't that look good over there? I mean, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. I mean, they get the eyes off of what God has done for them and the blessing that He's given them and get their eyes focused on the material things and the fleshly things and the carnal things, and they forsake the one who is the living water. Jesus spoke the same thing, John 4:10 and chapter 7, verse 38. They committed idolatry. They hewed out cisterns. The hewing probably represents the making of idols of wood and stone, to form them, to hew them out. And these idols were cisterns. And cisterns are for storing non-flowing, stagnant, stale water. They have no source in themselves. There is no source in them. That's what a cistern is for. It's to store water. In these cisterns, the water would get stale, stagnant. It's not flowing. See, whereas God says, I am living waters. See, Jesus said, come unto me, ye that thirst, and I will give you the drink of living waters, and they shall flow out of your belly. Living waters. It'll flow. Living waters. Moving. Living waters. And worse yet, these were broken cisterns. They couldn't even hold water from the heavens. Not even if God poured it in. So it was bad enough that they were cisterns and they were stale and there wasn't any life in them. But these were broken cisterns. Totally useless. This is spiritual insanity. Spiritual insanity. To give up the life of God and His Spirit for demonic carnal deception. To follow after the devil and his people. To worship his idols. Spiritual insanity. And it goes on all the time. It just shows the power of the devil. Now the hewing is a type of works righteousness. See, they hewed out cisterns. They were working out their salvation. It's man seeking God's blessing through his own works. See this in Exodus 20, verse 25. In Isaiah 64, 6, where God says, "All your righteousnesses are as filthy rags." Your works righteousness, that's nothing. It means absolutely nothing. Paul?
Physically, what were these cisterns? Were they in the shape of men?
No, it's just an image that he's portraying. The cisterns, a lot of them were dug out of stone, but I think they also made wooden cisterns too, and these were broken ones. And it's just an image he's portraying, because see, he's calling himself the fountain of living waters, flowing waters, and water is the picture, and life from the water, because that was the image they had of water. Where there was water, there was life. That's where the oases were in the desert, was where there was water. And so he's saying these are cisterns that hold stale water, because you know they recognized the image at that time, and they knew that. See, it was always preferable to have running water, because it was cleaner and it was more pure, and it usually was colder too, where the cistern water was stale and warm and brackish and yeah, you can represent programs too. Sure, anything that man will work up to promote, you know, and try and get life, trying to hold the life in. But really, they're broken cisterns. If you're trusting in those things, they're broken. Programs are all right as long as God's in them. And as soon as He's not in them, they're broken cisterns. They're useless. And they don't give life. Verse 14. Is Israel a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? Why is he spoiled? Now the first two questions, there's two views on the meaning. Either both questions beg a negative answer. In other words, saying that Israel is a son and not a servant. In other words, is he a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? You know, it's a rhetorical question. The answer is, no, he's a son. He's not a servant, he's a son. Israel is a son. Exodus 4:22. So you can see it that way, in which case the answer is, no, he's not, he's a son. Or you can see it the other direction. Both questions are yes in a different sense. Yes, he's a servant of Yahweh. And yes, he's one born in the household of God. He's being a homeborn slave was one who was very close and valuable. See? But in either case, you have the third question. Then why is he plundered? Why has he taken his spoil? God is showing, look, he's showing that Israel is close to him. Israel has a certain position in God. But why is he spoiled? Why is he plundered? Now God is speaking as though the judgment had already occurred in one sense. He's calling things that are not as though they are. And is showing the certainty of that judgment. But in another sense, it's also representing their current spiritual condition. Spiritually, they are plundered and they are spoiled. The devil has come in. They haven't been taken physically into captivity yet. But they are plundered. They are spoiled. See, now you have to remember that this is in the midst of the revival under Josiah still. And still, at that point in time, they are spiritually plundered. Now, they weren't about to receive that. It's like what happens, you know, God has been, in this assembly, God has been coming and He's been speaking difficult, hard things and sayings. He's been encouraging and all those things, but there's been some hard messages preached in the last few months. But wait a minute, aren't we in the midst of revival? Aren't we having the most glorious, wonderful time? Yes, and that's the time to take note. He brought the revival so that we'd get down on our faces. It's part of the test. It's part of the test. Will you go on the outward? Will you live on the glory? Will you fall asleep in the glory? Or will you see that now is the time to get serious? Now is the time to pay close attention to my calling. I'm giving you this glory so that you'll be in a good enough shape so that when I bring the hard things, you can make the decision and keep it and stick to it. That's His mercy. It really is. See, all these things that we have to go through, He gave us deliverance without all this wonderful, glorious things. Although we had some good, you know, it was good. We were singing in the Spirit, and wonderful things were happening. And He gave us deliverance, but we still didn't take the opportunity to get delivered. Not the way we should have, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having the difficulties we're having in this move, you know. Now He's forcing things right to the surface. There they are, boom. No more fooling around. No more, well, I'm not sure if I have that Spirit or not. It's there, and it's evident. See? But we didn't take care of it then the way we should have. So now he's given us like we have the agony and the ecstasy. You know, we have the glory and we have the hard times because we've got to deal with some things. And He's giving us the one so that we can bear the other. Really, my wife and I have talked about this quite a bit. And I feel in one sense, and she does too, that the hard things, that's where we're learning the most. That's where the most work is taking place. Because that's when we're being formed to be like Christ. He wants us to live and be seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus and experience those things. He really does. But He also wants us to be conformed to His sufferings and experience those. Yeah, Paul.
In what sense, what God said about forsaking Him, is there a revival going on? Was it mainly like a rediscovering of the Word which hardened the hearts? In what way was there a revival?
Well, partly it's prophetic, but also see, physically they were coming to Him, and you might say even with their hearts and their minds they were turning toward Him, but it's kind of the case of not taking care of the deep-seated things. They removed the idols such as they'd never done before. All the sacrifice places on the high hills, they took them down. All the different things that, you know, it talks about Solomon put up certain things, and in the Valley of Hinnom and all over the place, they took these things down and apart. But they didn't really turn fully with their hearts. And this is evidence. See, this is the same thing that happened under Hezekiah. Under Hezekiah, they had a revival too. But right after Hezekiah came Manasseh, and they went right downhill. I mean, it was just like a straight shot. It didn't even wait, you know. It didn't even take a generation, you know, before they were right back in the same things that Hezekiah had brought them out of. And it's the same thing with Josiah. When Josiah died, I mean, the revival ended. Because the revival was really only because Josiah was a godly king. And there were a few others, of course. But the majority of the people, they went along with it. And it's not that they weren't living, in a sense, righteous and holy lives at that time, at least as much as they were able to, but the commitments weren't made. They weren't established. They weren't solid. In other words, it was because of one man, so to speak, that there was that they were walking with God. But if no one else was going to lead them after that, you know, they didn't learn. They didn't learn from the lesson. Yeah, Paul.
What I don't see it in that. What would cause God to bring stronger judgment, even to cut him off?
Well, this is prophetical, okay? And the stronger judgment is really coming because of a buildup of things and because He knows what they're going to do afterwards, okay? He's really trying to get them at this point in time to make the commitments. But see, under Manasseh it was set. The judgment was set under Manasseh. Can't recall the exact wording of it. But because of Manasseh's sins, it says, that was the cause. And the people, see, these were the same, a lot of these were the same people as under Manasseh and Ammon, Manasseh's son. And they were full of these things. They were full of them. And yes, they turned in the outward, but basically, you know, it was just kind of a, well, you know, we'll go along with this for now. This seems good, you know, we'll... It's kind of like what happens in this country sometimes. We have these swings from righteousness to immorality, you know, and now it's getting pretty well mixed. But, I mean, there'd be these swings back and forth, you know, evidenced by the rising and falling of skirt levels and things like that, you know. Now it's just kind of gotten all wild everywhere, and you can't tell anything anymore. But see, even at those times when the righteousness comes in, it's like right now there's a move toward that. Even amongst the churches, they're getting active, you know, and they're promoting righteousness and things like that. But see what's going to happen in the future when the devil comes. The majority of them are not going to continue in that righteousness. In other words, they just kind of move and flow with the ebb, you know. However the tide is moving, you know, in righteousness or not, you know, because they haven't made the commitments. And this is what's happening to the people. And God is trying to wake them up. He's trying to wake them up. And the judgment is set because of Manasseh, but it's also set by foreknowledge. He knew what they were going to do, okay? He knew that in reality they had forsaken him in their hearts. Now, they did have revival under Josiah, but it was really a one-man revival. Really a one-man revival. And that won't hold you, you know, if we're dependent. See, it's not, it's like Pastor Don, you know, if he said, if everybody stops walking with God, we've got to be in a place to walk with God no matter what, and not flow with ebb and tide. Otherwise, we'll be out the door one day. Really, not because he'll backslide, but because that weakness will draw you away eventually, because the commitment won't be made, and there will come a testing sometime that you will not pass. And this is where they were. Their hearts were not, you know, their faces weren't set like flint for God. They were just, well, okay, now we're doing righteous things. Now we're getting rid of them. But in their heart, they weren't free from them yet. See, the Pharisees didn't kill, didn't commit adultery. They were clean. I mean, by all standards, they were righteous and holy. But what did Jesus say? If you hate your brother in your heart, it's as though you've committed murder. If you lust after a woman in your heart, it's as though you've committed adultery, see? He was pointing right to where their hearts really were. Yeah, we're clean on the outward. We're doing everything right. I mean, I wash my hands the proper number of times, and I do this, and I stay away from all the lepers, and I only carry one dried fig unless it's on my back, and I have the option that I can reach back there and eat it while I'm walking, you know, on the Sabbath, or, you know, understand? See, in their hearts, they showed that they were not really following after God. That's why Jesus said, if you were Abraham's children, then you would do the works of Abraham, and you would know me. But they didn't. And it's not that on the outward they weren't righteous. They were righteous on the outward. And they looked good. And that's what the deception was. Everything looked good. We must be okay. God is pleased with us. You know, there were some that felt that if everybody would keep the law for one day, the Messiah would come. But it was the Amharids, you know, the people of the land. They wouldn't walk with God, and so we have to suffer through all this. Their hearts were hardened against the truth. And this is the way the people were at the time. See, even in the midst of revival. And we have to guard ourselves against that same attitude. That we're, well, you know, bless God, we're part of Community Chapel. And Community Chapel is going to be in the man-child. And that's, I mean, I can move with this. And that testing will come one day, and you'll find out. You'll find out. Everything that can be shaken will be shaken. Everything. Every commitment you make, every decision, you're going to be tried on it. You're going to be tested. This is why we've got to get our hearts in that place. And really make our election and calling sure. Verse 15. The young lions roared upon him and yelled, and they made his land waste. His cities are burned without inhabitant. They're spoiled, remember? The lions have run upon him. The lions represent the nations around about them. See this in Isaiah 5, verses 26 through 30. And Zechariah 11:3. They're young lions, ones that kill for bloodlust. They're vicious, violent, bloodthirsty. It's not for food, it's for bloodlust. Just to learn how to kill. Young lions will go out, and just because they've learned how to kill and they have the power, will kill. And this represents Assyria over Israel. And that was fulfilled. It did happen. Okay, and this was, he's bringing this up, saying, look, see, haven't you seen the judgment? It also represents Assyria and Egypt against Judah in various past invasions. They've been spoiled. You've been spoiled. But he's also talking about Babylon coming over Judah, a young lion, a new powerful nation. Now, Babylon had been a powerful nation prior to this, some probably 800-900 years before in the first kingdom. But here they're essentially a new nation, a new major power, young lion coming up over Judah. And so it's prophetic of Babylon coming. It's also pointing toward the Antichrist coming against the Jews in the last days. Okay, as a young lion. No, he's going to be young. He's going to be, I mean, not in the sense of being 25 years old, but it's in one sense it's an old power because it's of the devil, but in another sense it's new. You know, there's the 10 kings, and then there's, remember in Daniel it talks about, and there arose another horn, and it destroyed the power of three of them, or took the power of three of them is the idea behind it. See, and that represents the Antichrist coming up. It's going to be very quick. It's going to be a young lion, and he's going to come, and he's going to attack the Jews. It says that their cities are burned without inhabitant. Rotherham says, so as to have no inhabitant. In other words, they're in utter ruin, so that none would want to dwell in them. They're totally ruined. The cities are ruined. Nobody wants to dwell in them. They're ruined because of sin. And that's the truth. It's sin that caused the ruin of those cities. If there's ruin in our lives, we can know that it's sin. You know, it's the devil who comes and ruins and destroys. That's what he comes for. The thief cometh not but to destroy and to rob and to steal. Okay? But he comes, and if he's able to rob and to steal from you, it's because of sin in your life. And so it was with them. Their sin is what was the cause of their destruction of their cities. That's why the lions came up. Verse 16. Also the children of Noph and Tahpenes have broken the crown of thy head. Noph is Memphis, the ancient capital of Lower Egypt, and Tahpenes is a strong border city in northeast Egypt. You can see that in Jeremiah 43, verses 7 through 9. And they have broken. That is, they means to break or to make desolate. It's, let's see, it's referring to the shaving of the head. The crown is broken. Okay, it's referring to the shaving of the head. And this was a great curse and disgrace to have your head shaved. To the Hebrews it was. It was a great curse and a disgrace. See this in chapter 48, verse 37, and Isaiah chapter 7, verse 20. It also represents the removal of authority and position. They're put in disgrace and shame. The crown of their head, you know, their position of authority, their power, it's broken. It's destroyed. This happened, 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. Shishak shamed Rehoboam. Also, Pharaoh Necho killed Josiah and deposed Jehoahaz and put Jehoiakim on the throne and put the land under heavy tribute. They were shamed. Their power was broken. They had no rule anymore, no authority. Others were leading them and ruling them. For Pharaoh Necho, you can see in 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 29 and verses 31 through 35. Verse 17, hast thou not procured this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God when he led thee by the way? They sowed to the flesh, and now the judgment is being reaped. Haven't you procured this to yourself? You purchased it for yourself. You bought it for yourself. Your sin has bought it for you. See Numbers 32:23. These are his promises to you. If you're not going to walk with me, you're going to receive the reward of that. Hosea 8:7 also in chapter 13, verse 9 in Hosea. And in Galatians 6:7 it says, God is not mocked. God is not mocked. Whatsoever you sow, that shall you also reap. You're getting just what you deserve. Now the way here, speaking of two things. One, God leading them as a nation out of Egypt into Canaan. Okay? So when you forsook the Lord thy God when he led thee by the way. Okay, as early as that they began to forsake him. He led them by the way. But more particularly, speaking of the way of holiness, this is what he showed them. He showed it to them in the tabernacle. He showed it to them in the Levitical priesthood, that the way was holiness. The high priest had on his forehead holiness unto the Lord. And this is what Israel was to be. The high priest represented all of Israel. And so he led them in the way, but they forsook him. They forsook his way. They forsook his holiness. He showed them clearly how to walk with him. He gave them the law. He gave them the ability to do it too. But they wouldn't. So they forsook him. They went another way. Verse 18. And now what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt? He's talking about the way. You've left my way, so now you're in the way of Egypt to drink the waters of Sihor. Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river? Now Sihor is literally black or muddy river. That is the Nile. And to drink of their waters was to fellowship with them, to partake of their lifeblood, because the Nile was the lifeblood of Egypt. And they did this through alliances and through adopting foreign ways and customs and vices and idolatry and gods and sin. They adopted those things. They partook of their lifeblood. They fellowshipped, you know. What fellowship hath light with darkness? What fellowship hath Belial, you know, with God? There is none. But this is what they did. They forsook God. They forsook His fellowship for the fellowship with demons. Now the river here is the Euphrates, and that's the symbol of Assyria. And it was also the lifeblood. It was the lifeblood of that nation. And so they were partaking of it. And they had alliances with them. And they took their foreign ways. They took they took wives from among them. All the things God said don't do, they did it. God is asking, why have these nations that represent sin, which are set to destroy you, why are they being sought for friendship? Why are they being sought for friendship? See, friendship with the world is enmity with God. And so to seek that friendship is to forsake God and to seek enmity with God. So they had turned to the way of Egypt. They had forsaken His way and turned to the way of Egypt and the way of Assyria. Verse 19. Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backsliding shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that it is an evil thing and bitter that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that my fear is not in thee, saith the Lord God of hosts. Your sin will find you out. Galatians 6:8. If you sow to the flesh, from the flesh shall reap corruption. Your sin will find you out. Their alliances brought them only misery. Said you trusting in a broken reed that will pierce your hand going to Egypt. See, God has laid out spiritual laws for His people. Now He also laid out the natural laws, but behind them basically were spiritual laws. And it's just like the natural laws. You jump off a cliff, you're going to hit the bottom real hard. It just follows. That's the way the laws are. It's not, you know, wishful thinking or hoping, well, maybe I won't. Or jumping off a cliff and saying, oh, God, save me, you know. I'm going to trust in you. He said, look, I set the laws. I set them in order. Even a child can see that. He falls down and gets hurt. So he's not going to go jumping off cliffs. I mean, you take a small child and trying to get him to jump 3 feet off, from 3 feet off the ground into your arms. There's a natural fear against it because they know they can get hurt. But here he said, he set spiritual laws. And that's what's behind all of the Levitical things. There were spiritual laws set in order. The spirit of the law was there. And these laws have both spiritual and temporal consequences, both positive and negative. This is why you take a look at the Mormons, and in a natural sense, they do, most of them do quite well. Those that really follow after Mormonism do fairly well. They tithe, you know. They do well. You know, they own, I think it's something like the profit of the Mormon church is something like $1 million a day. That's just their clear profit. Because they follow the laws of God in that sense. They live outwardly, or try to live outwardly holy lives. And they do things that are right. They follow, in a sense, the spiritual laws of God. And God blesses them. Or the blessing comes. In other words, they're fitting right in with the laws. And because of that, the laws say you'll be blessed. You'll be blessed. And so they're blessed. So if we follow His laws, we'll be blessed too. Now, because they're not following Him spiritually, they're going to reap terrible spiritual consequences. And their lives spiritually are not a good life. But they can live decent, happy lives in one sense, in the worldly sense. They can live decent, happy lives. They have family life because they promote the things that God promotes, except for salvation. They try and do it all in the outward, all by their own works. But see, it just shows that there are laws that God has set in order. That's why he said, "Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backsliding shall reprove thee." In one sense, God doesn't really have to do anything. And in another, if we can see it, he's really holding back the judgment. He's holding back the judgment. So there are temporal consequences and spiritual consequences to these spiritual laws that he has set in order. He has set them in order for our lives. And if we will follow them, then blessings will come, both spiritually and temporally. The problem with the faith, the hyper-faith teaching right now, is that the focus is on the temporal blessings to receive. I mean, they do preach the spiritual blessings too, but the focus is too much on the temporal blessings. And they're following the law of God in that. They do preach to some degree, it depends on the people who are doing it, but the more middle-of-the-road ones are teaching, you know, a measure of holiness. I mean, a measure. It's not real dying-to-self kind of holiness the way it should be, but they're teaching a measure of holiness, and that their blessing in God is going to be dependent upon that to some degree. Okay? So they recognize the spiritual laws exist. Now, the focus is too much on the temporal, but they can see. It's clear. There are spiritual laws that affect our lives. And so, if we sin, our sin will find us out. It'll reprove us. And it's become... their sin has now become evil and bitterness to them. It was pleasurable, but now it's evil and bitterness to them. And why is that? Because the fear of God was not in them. They didn't fear God. They didn't fear God. And that is the reason why they sinned. That's the reason why they went as far as they have gone, because they didn't fear God. Verse 20. One thing, the Rotherham says, "thy backslidings." He calls it "thine apostasies." It's another word for it there. Verse 20. Yes?
I was going to say that bitterness, I've had an opportunity to minister to many brothers and sisters that have been put out. And in every one of them, there's bitterness.
And it's usually directed back toward the church or the pastor or the elder or whoever was involved in the situation. There's a bitterness because of their own unwillingness.
Interesting. It says that the people think it's bitter, not forsaken.
Mm-hmm. Verse 20. "For of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou saidst, I will not transgress. When upon every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest, playing the harlot." Now the Latin Vulgate and the Septuagint and some other manuscripts read it as, "Judah burst the bands of God's law and said, I will not obey." Either way, what is being said is they committed spiritual adultery. Now, God, in the way the King James has it, is probably the best rendering. Okay, "For of old time I have broken thy yoke." This is when they were under bondage in Egypt. "I have broken your yoke, and I burst thy bands. See, you are free people because I set you free. And you said, I will not transgress." And this is what they said in Joshua chapter 24, verses 16 through 18, and verse 21 and 24. They said, "I will not transgress. We'll walk with God." This is when Joshua said, "You won't walk with God." And they said, "Yes, we'll walk with God." And he said, "No, you won't walk with God." And they said, "Yes, we commit before God, we'll walk with God." He said, "Well, then put away your idols." Even at that time, God burst the bands. And they said, "I will not transgress." But very soon after his death, what do we see in Judges? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. "I will not transgress." But they did anyway. They did anyway. They committed the spiritual adultery, wandering about as a harlot, upon every high hill and every green tree, playing the harlot. It's a sad picture. They defiled the land under every green tree, upon every high hill, just openly, wide open, sin and rebellion. Verse 21. "Yet I had planted thee a noble vine, holy a right seed. How then art thou turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto me? A noble vine they were planted, of the stock of Abraham, but they didn't bear Abraham's fruit. See that in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 1 through 7, and John chapter 8, verse 39. We'll start there tomorrow.